new Dromans. The sight of them upon the black water with King Tommen's banner flying from their masts will remind the city who rules here, and keep them safe should the mobs decide to run riot again. He left the rest unspoken. Once on the Blackwater, his Dromans could stop Mace Tyrell from bringing his army back across the river, just as Tyrion had once stopped Stannis. Highgarden had no sea power of its own this side of Westeros. They relied upon the Redwine fleet, presently on its way back to the Arbor. "A prudent measure," the Queen announced. "Until this storm has passed, I want your ships crewed and on the water." Sir Harry's Swift was so pale and damp he looked about to faint. "When word of this reaches Lord Tyrell, his fury will know no bounds. There will be blood in the streets." "The Night of the Yellow Chicken," Cersei mused. "You ought to take a worm for your sigil, sir. A chicken is too bold for you. If Mace Tyrell were not even Salt Storm's End, how do you imagine that he would ever dare attack the gods?" When he was done blathering, she said, "It must not come to blood, and I mean to see that it does not. I will go to Baelor Sept myself to speak to Queen Margaery and the High Septon. Tommen loves them both, I know, and would want me to make peace between them." "Peace?" Sir Harry's dabbed at his brow with a velvet sleeve. "If peace is possible, that is very brave of you." "Some sort of trial may be necessary," said the Queen, "to disprove these base calumnies and lies, and show the world that our sweet Margaery is the innocent we all know her to be." "Aye," said Merryweather, "but this High Septon may want to try the Queen himself, as the Faith once tried men of old." "I hope so," Cersei thought. Such a court was not like to look with favor on treasonous queens who spread their legs for singers and profane the maiden's holy rites to hide their shame. "The important thing is to find the truth. I am sure we all agree," she said. "And now, my lords, you must excuse me. I must go see the king. He should not be alone at such a time." Tommen was fishing for cats when his mother returned to him. Dorcas had made him a mouse with scraps of fur and tied it on a long string at the end of an old fishing pole. The kittens loved to chase it, and the boy liked nothing better than jerking it about the floor as they pounced after it. He seemed surprised when Cersei gathered him up in her arms and kissed him on his brow. "What's that for, Mother? Why are you crying?" "Because you're safe," she wanted to tell him, "because no harm will ever come to you." "You are mistaken. A lion never cries." There would be time later to tell him about Margaery and her cousins. "There are some warrants that I need you to sign." For the king's sake, the queen had left the names off the arrest warrants. Tommen signed them blank and pressed his seal into the warm wax happily, as he always did. Afterward, she sent him off with Jocelyn Swift. Sir Osfrid Kettleblack arrived as the ink was drying. Cersei had written in the names herself. Sir Tallard the Tall, Jalabar Zoe, Hamish the Harper, Hugh Clifton, Mark Mullendore, Bayard Norcross, Lambert Turnberry, Horace Redwine, Hobber Redwine, and a certain churl named Watt, who called himself the Blue Bard. "So many." Sir Osfrid shuffled through the warrants, as wary of the words as if they had been roaches crawling across the parchment. None of the Kettleblacks could read. 10. You have 6,000 gold cloaks. Sufficient for 10, I would think. Some of the clever ones may have fled, if the rumors reach their ears in time. If so, it makes no matter. Their absence only makes them look that much more guilty. Sir Tallard is a bit of an oaf, and may try to resist you. See that he does not die before confessing, and do no harm to any of the others. A few may well be innocent. It was important that the Redwine twins be found to have been falsely accused. That would demonstrate the fairness of the judgments against the others. We'll have them all before the sun comes up, Your Grace. Sir Osfrid hesitated. There's a crowd gathering outside the door of Baelor's Sept. What sort of crowd? Anything unexpected made her wary. She remembered what Lord Waters had said about the riots. I had not considered how the small folk might react to this. Margaery has been their little pet. How many? 100 or so. They're shouting for the High Septon to release the little queen. We can send them running if you like. No, Let them shout until they're hoarse. It will not sway the sparrow. He only listens to the gods. There was a certain irony in His High Holiness having an angry mob encamped upon his doorstep, since just such a mob had raised him to the crystal crown, which he promptly sold. The faith has its own knights now. Let them defend the sept. Oh, and close the city gates as well. No one is to enter or leave King's Landing without my leave, until all this is done and settled. As you command, Your Grace. Sir Osfrid bowed and went off to find someone to read the warrants to him. By the time the sun went down that day, all of the accused traitors were in custody. Hamish the Harper had collapsed when they came for him, and Sir Talad the Tall had wounded 3 gold cloaks before the others overwhelmed him. Circe ordered that the Redwine twins be given comfortable chambers in a tower. The rest went down to the dungeons. "Hamish is having difficulty breathing," Kyburn informed her when he came to call that night. "He is calling for a maester. Tell him he can have one as soon as he confesses." She thought a moment. He is too old to have been amongst the lovers, but no doubt he was made to play and sing for Marjorie whilst she was entertaining other men. We will need details. I shall help him to remember them, Your Grace. The next day, Lady Merryweather helped Circe dress for their visit to the little queen. "Nothing too rich or colourful," she said. "Something suitably devout and drab for the High Septon. He's like to make me pray with him." In the end, she chose a soft woolen dress that covered her from throat to ankle, with only a few small vines embroidered on the bodice and the sleeves in golden thread to soften the severity of its lines. Even better, brown would help conceal the dirt if she was made to kneel. "Whilst I am comforting my good daughter, you shall speak with the 3 cousins," she told Tena. "Win Allah, if you can, but be careful what you say. The gods may not be the only ones listening." Jaime always said that the hardest part of any battle is just before, waiting for the carnage to begin. When she stepped outside, Circe saw that the sky was grey and bleak. She could not take the risk of being caught in a downpour and arriving at Baelor's sept soaked and bedraggled. That meant the litter. For her escort, she took 10 Lannister houseguards and Boros Blount. "Marjorie's mob may not have the wit to tell one kettle black from another," she told Sir Osmond, "and I cannot have you cutting through the commons. Best we keep you out of sight for a time." As they made their way across King's Landing, Tena had a sudden doubt. "This trial," she said in a quiet voice, "what if Marjorie demands that her guilt or innocence be determined by wager of battle?" A smile brushed Circe's lips. "As queen, her honour must be defended by a knight of the King's Guard. Why, every child in Westeros knows how Prince Aemon the Dragon Knight championed his sister, Queen Nereis, against Sir Morgil's accusations. With Sir Loras so gravely wounded, though, I fear Prince Aemon's part must fall to one of his sworn brothers." She shrugged. "Who, though? Sir Aris and Sir Balon are far away in Dorne. Jaime is off at River Run, and Sir Osmond is the brother of the man accusing her, which leaves only, oh dear, Boros Blount and Merrin Trant." Lady Tena laughed. "Yes, and Sir Merrin has been feeling ill of late. Remind me to tell him that when we return to the castle." "I shall, my sweet." Tena took her hand and kissed it. "I pray that I never offend you. You are terrible when roused." "Any mother would do the same to protect her children," said Circe. "When do you mean to bring that boy of yours to court? Russell, was that his name? He could train with Tommen. That would thrill the boy, I know. But things are so uncertain just now. I thought it best to wait until the danger passed." "Soon enough," promised Circe. "Send word to Long Table, and have Russell pack his best doublet and his wooden sword. A new young friend will be just the thing to help Tommen forget his loss after Marjorie's little head has rolled." They descended from the litter under Blessed Baylor's statue. The queen was pleased to see that the bones and filth had been cleaned away. Sir Osfrid had told it true. The crowd was neither as numerous nor as unruly as the sparrows had been. They stood about in small clumps, gazing sullenly at the doors of the great sept, where a line of novice septons had been drawn up with quarterstaffs in their hands. No steel, Circe noted. That was either very wise or very stupid. She was not sure which. No one made any attempt to hinder her. Small folk and novices alike parted as they passed. Once inside the doors, they were met by three knights in the Hall of Lamps, each clad in the rainbow-striped robes of the warrior's sons. "I am here to see my good daughter," Circe told them. "His High Holiness has been expecting you. I am Sir Theoden the True, formerly Sir Theoden Wells, if your grace will come with me." The High Sparrow was on his knees, as ever. This time he was praying before the father's altar. Nor did he break off his prayer when the queen approached, but made her wait impatiently until he had finished. Only then did he rise and bow to her. "Your grace, this is a sad day."
"Very sad. Do we have your leave to speak with Marjorie and her cousins?"
She chose a meek and humble manner. With this man, that was like to work the best.
"If that is your wish, come to me afterward, my child. We must pray together, you and I."
The little queen had been confined atop one of the great sept's slender towers. Her cell was 8 feet long and 6 feet wide, with no furnishings but a straw-stuffed pallet and a bench for prayer, a ewer of water, a copy of the seven-pointed star, and a candle to read it by. The only window was hardly wider than an arrow slit. Circe found Marjorie barefoot and shivering, clad in the rough-spun shift of a novice sister. Her locks were all a tangle, and her feet were filthy.
"They took my clothes from me,"
the little queen told her once they were alone.
"I wore a gown of ivory lace with fresh-water pearls on the bodice, but the scepters laid their hands on me and stripped me to the skin. My cousins, too. Mega sent one scepter crashing into the candles and set her robe afire. I fear for Allah, though. She went as white as milk, too frightened even to cry."
"Poor child." There were no chairs, so Circe sat beside the little queen on her pallet. "Lady Tena has gone to speak with her, to let her know that she is not forgotten."
"He will not even let me see them,"
fumed Marjorie. "He keeps each of us apart from the others. Until you came, I was allowed no visitors but scepters. One comes every hour to ask if I wish to confess my fornications. They will not even let me sleep. They wake me to demand confessions. Last night I confessed to Scepter Unella that I wished to scratch her eyes out."
"A shame you did not do it," Circe thought. "Blinding some poor old scepter would certainly persuade the High Sparrow of your guilt."
"They are questioning your cousins the same way."
"Damn them, then," said Marjorie. "Damn them all to seven hells.
Allah is gentle and shy. How can they do this to her? And Mega, she laughs as loud as a dockside whore, I know, but inside she's still just a little girl. I love them all, and they love me. If this sparrow thinks to make them lie about me."
"They stand accused as well, I fear. All three."
"My cousins?"
Marjorie paled.
"Allah and Mega are hardly more than children. Your Grace, this is obscene. Will you take us out of here?"
"Would that I could."
Her voice was full of sorrow. "His High Holiness has his new knights guarding you. To free you, I would need to send the gold cloaks and profane this holy place with killing." Circe took Marjorie's hand in hers. "I have not been idle, though. I have gathered up all those that Sir Osney named as your lovers. They will tell His High Holiness of your innocence, I am certain, and swear to it at your trial."
"Trial?"
There was real fear in the girl's voice now.
"Must there be a trial?
How else will you prove your innocence?"
Circe gave Marjorie's hand a reassuring squeeze. "It is your right to decide the manner of the trial, to be sure. You are the queen. The knights of the king's guard are sworn to defend you." Marjorie understood at once.
"A trial by battle. Loras is hurt, though. Elsewise he has six brothers."
Marjorie stared at her, then pulled her hand away.
"Is that a jape? Boros is a craven. Merin is old and slow. Your brother is maimed. The other two are off in Dorne. And Osmond is a bloody kettleblack.
Loras has two brothers, not six. If there's to be a trial by battle, I want Garlon as my champion."
Sir Garlon is not a member of the King's Guard, the Queen said. When the Queen's honour is at issue, law and custom require that her champion be one of the King's sworn seven. The High Septon will insist, I fear.
I will make certain of it.
Marjorie did not answer at once, but her brown eyes narrowed in suspicion. Blount or Trent, she said at last. It would have to be one of them. You'd like that, wouldn't you? Osney Kettleblack would cut either one to pieces.
Seven hells.
Circe donned a look of hurt. You wrong me, daughter. All I want is your son, all for yourself. He will never have a wife that you don't hate, and I am not your daughter, thank the gods. Leave me. You are being foolish. I am only here to help you, to help me to my grave. I asked for you to leave. Will you make me call my jailers and have you dragged away, you vile, scheming, evil bitch?
Circe gathered up her skirts and dignity.
This must be very frightening for you. I shall forgive those words.
Here, as at court, one never knew who might be listening.
I would be afraid as well in your place. Grand Maester Pycelle has admitted providing you with moon tea, and your blue bard. If I were you, my lady, I would pray to the crone for wisdom and to the mother for her mercy. I fear you may soon be in dire need of both.
Four shriveled scepters escorted the queen down the tower steps. Each of the crones seemed more feeble than the last. When they reached the ground, they continued down into the heart of Visenya's Hill. The steps ended well below the earth, where a line of flickering torches lit a long hallway. She found the High Septon waiting for her in a small seven-sided audience chamber. The room was sparse and plain, with bare stone walls, a rough-hewn table, three chairs, and a prayer bench. The faces of the seven had been carved into the walls. Circe thought the carvings crude and ugly, but there was a certain power to them, especially about the eyes, orbs of onyx, malachite, and yellow moonstone that somehow made the faces come alive.
"You spoke with the queen," the High Septon said. She resisted the urge to say, "I am the queen."
"I did. All men sin, even kings and queens. I have sinned myself and been forgiven. Without confession, though, there can be no forgiveness. The queen will not confess. Perhaps she is innocent. She is not. Holy scepters have examined her and testify that her maidenhead is broken. She has drunk of moon tea to murder the fruit of her fornications in her womb. An anointed knight has sworn upon his sword to having carnal knowledge of her, and two of her three cousins. Others have lain with her as well, he says, and names many names of men both great and humble.
My gold cloaks have taken all of them to the dungeons, Circe assured him. Only one has yet been questioned, a singer called the Blue Bard. What he had to say was disturbing. Even so, I pray that when my good daughter is brought to trial, her innocence may yet be proved. She hesitated. Tommen loves his little queen so much, Your Holiness. I fear it might be hard for him or his lords to judge her justly. Perhaps the faith should conduct the trial?
The High Sparrow steepled his thin hands. I have had the self-same thought, Your Grace. Just as Maegor the Cruel once took the swords from the faith, so Jaehaerys the Conciliator deprived us of the scales of judgment. Yet who is truly fit to judge a queen, save the seven above and the godsworn below? A sacred court of seven judges shall sit upon this case. Three shall be of your female sex, a maiden, a mother, and a crone. Who could be more suited to judge the wickedness of women?
That would be for the best. To be sure, Marjorie does have the right to demand that her guilt or innocence be proven by wager of battle. If so, her champion must be one of Tommen's seven.
The knights of the King's Guard have served as the rightful champions of king and queen since the days of Aegon the Conqueror. Crown and faith speak as one on this.
Circe covered her face with her hands as in grief. When she raised her head again, a tear glistened in one eye. These are sad days indeed, she said, but I am pleased to find us so much in agreement. If Tommen were here, I know he would thank you. Together, you and I must find the truth.
We shall.
I must return to the castle. With your leave, I will take Sir Osney Kettleblack back with me. The small council will want to question him and hear his accusations for themselves.
No, said the High Septon.
It was only a word, one little word, but to Circe it felt like a splash of icy water in the face. She blinked, and her certainty flickered just a little. Sir Osney will be held securely, I promise you.
He is held securely here. Come, I will show you.
Circe could feel the eyes of the seven staring at her, eyes of jade and malachite and onyx, and a sudden shiver of fear went through her, cold as ice.
I am the queen, she told herself, Lord Tywin's daughter.
Reluctantly she followed. Sir Osney was not far. The chamber was dark and closed by a heavy iron door. The High Septon produced the key to open it and took a torch down from the wall to light the room within.
After you, Your Grace.
Within, Osney Kettleblack hung naked from the ceiling, swinging from a pair of heavy iron chains. He had been whipped. His back and shoulders had been laid almost bare, and cuts and welts crisscrossed his legs and arse as well. The Queen could hardly stand to look at him. She turned back to the High Septon.
What have you done?
We have sought after the truth, most earnestly.
He told you the truth. He came to you of his own free will and confessed his sins.
Aye, he did that. I have heard many men confess, Your Grace, but seldom have I heard a man so pleased to be so guilty.
You whipped him.
There can be no penance without pain. No man should spare himself the scourge. As I told Sir Osney, I seldom feel so close to God as when I am being whipped for mine own wickedness, though my darkest sins are no wise near as black as his.
But, she sputtered, you preach the mother's mercy.
Sir Osney shall taste of that sweet milk in the afterlife. In the seven-pointed star it is written that all sins may be forgiven, but crimes must still be punished. Osney Kettleblack is guilty of treason and murder, and the wages of treason are death.
He is just a priest. He cannot do this.
It is not for the faith to condemn a man to death, whatever his offense.
Whatever his offense.
The High Septon repeated the words slowly, weighing them. Strange to say, Your Grace, the more diligently we applied the scourge, the more Sir Osney's offences seemed to change. He would now have us believe that he never touched Margaery Tyrell. Is that not so, Sir Osney?
Osney Kettleblack opened his eyes. When he saw the Queen standing there before him, he ran his tongue across his swollen lips and said,
The wall. You promised me the wall.
He is mad, said Circe. You have driven him mad.
Sir Osney, said the High Septon in a firm, clear voice, did you have carnal knowledge of the Queen?
Aye.
The chains rattled softly as Osney twisted in his shackles.
That one there, she's the Queen I fucked. The one sent me to kill the old High Septon. He never had no guards. I just come in when he was sleeping and pushed a pillow down across his face.
Circe whirled and ran. The High Septon tried to seize her, but he was some old sparrow, and she was a lioness of the rock. She pushed him aside and burst through the door, slamming it behind her with a clang.
The Kettleblacks! I need the Kettleblacks! I will send in Osfrid with the gold cloaks and Osmond with the Kingsguard. Osney will deny it all once they cut him free, and I'll rid myself of this High Septon just as I did the other.
The four old scepters blocked her way and clutched at her with wrinkled hands. She knocked one to the floor and clawed another across the face and gained the steps. Halfway up, she remembered Taina Merryweather. It made her stumble, panting.
Seven, save me, she prayed. Taina knows it all. If they take her too and whip her.
She ran as far as the sept, but no farther. There were women waiting for her there, more scepters and silent sisters too, younger than the four old crones below.
I am the Queen, she shouted, backing away from them. I will have your heads for this. I will have all your heads. Let me pass.
Instead, they laid hands upon her.
Circe ran to the altar of the mother, but they caught her there, a score of them, and dragged her kicking up the tower steps. Inside the cell, three silent sisters held her down as a scepter named Scholera stripped her bare. She even took her small clothes. Another scepter tossed a rough-spun shift at her.
"You cannot do this!"
the queen kept screaming at them. "I am a Lannister. Unhand me. My brother will kill you. Jaime will slice you open from throat to cunt. Unhand me. I am the queen."
"The queen should pray," said Scepter Scholera, before they left her naked in the cold, bleak cell. She was not meek Margaery Tyrell to don her little shift and submit to such captivity. "I will teach them what it means to put a lion in a cage," Circe thought. She tore the shift into 100 pieces, found a ewer of water and smashed it against the wall, then did the same with the chamber pot. When no one came, she began to pound on the door with her fists. Her escort was below, on the plaza, 10 Lannister guardsmen and Sir Boros Blount. "Once they hear, they'll come free me and will drag the bloody High Sparrow back to the Red Keep in chains." She screamed and kicked and howled until her throat was raw, at the door and at the window. No one shouted back nor came to rescue her. The cell began to darken. It was growing cold as well. Circe began to shiver. "How can they leave me like this without so much as a fire? I am their queen." She began to regret tearing apart the shift they'd given her. There was a blanket on the pallet in the corner, a threadbare thing of thin brown wool. It was rough and scratchy, but it was all she had. Circe huddled underneath to keep from shivering, and before long she had fallen into an exhausted sleep. The next she knew, a heavy hand was shaking her awake. It was black as pitch inside the cell, and a huge, ugly woman was kneeling over her, a candle in her hand.
"Who are you?"
the queen demanded. "Are you come to set me free?"
"I am Scepter Unella. I am come to hear you tell of all your murders and fornications."
Circe knocked her hand aside.
"I will have your head. Do not presume to touch me. Get away."
The woman rose.
"Your Grace, I will be back in an hour. Mayhaps by then you will be ready to confess."
An hour, and an hour, and an hour. So passed the longest night that Circe Lannister had ever known, save for the night of Joffrey's wedding. Her throat was so raw from shouting that she could hardly swallow. The cell turned freezing cold. She had smashed the chamber pot, so she had to squat in a corner to make her water and watch it trickle across the floor. Every time she closed her eyes, Unella was looming over her again, shaking her and asking her if she wanted to confess her sins. Day brought no relief. Scepter Moel brought her a bowl of some watery grey gruel as the sun was coming up. Circe flung it at her head. When they brought a fresh ewer of water, though, she was so thirsty that she had no choice but to drink. When they brought her another shift, grey and thin and smelling of mildew, she put it on over her nakedness. And that evening, when Moel appeared again, she ate the bread and fish and demanded wine to wash it down. No wine appeared, only Scepter Unella, making her hourly visit to ask if the queen was ready to confess.
"What can be happening?"
Circe wondered, as the thin slice of sky outside her window began to darken once again. "Why has no one come to pry me out of here?" She could not believe that the Kettleblacks would abandon their brother. What was her council doing? "Cravens and traitors, when I get out of here I will have the lot of them beheaded and find better men to take their place." Thrice that day she heard the sound of distant shouting drifting up from the plaza. But it was Margaery's name that the mob was calling, not hers. It was near dawn on the second day, and Circe was licking the last of the porridge from the bottom of the bowl when her cell door swung open unexpectedly to admit Lord Qyburn. It was all she could do not to throw herself at him.
"Qyburn," she whispered, "oh gods, I am so glad to see your face. Take me home."
"That will not be allowed. You are to be tried before a holy court of 7 for murder, treason, and fornication."
Circe was so exhausted that the words seemed nonsensical to her at first.
"Tommen, tell me of my son. Is he still king?"
"He is, your grace. He is safe and well, secure within the walls of Maegor's Holdfast, protected by the Kingsguard. He is lonely, though, fretful. He asks for you and for his little queen.
As yet no one has told him of your difficulties, she suggested. What of Margery? She is to be tried as well by the same court that conducts your trial. I had the blue bard delivered to the High Septon as your grace commanded. He is here now, somewhere down below us. My whisperers tell me that they are whipping him, but so far he is still singing the same sweet song we taught him. The same sweet song. Her wits were dull for want of sleep. Wat. His real name is Wat. If the gods were good, Wat might die beneath the lash, leaving Margery with no way to disprove his testimony. Where are my knights, Sir Osfrid? The High Septon means to kill his brother, Osney. His gold cloaks must... Osfrid Kettleblack no longer commands the city watch. The king has removed him from office and raised the captain of the Dragon Gate in his place, a certain Humphrey Waters. Circe was so tired, none of this made any sense. Why would Tommen do that? The boy is not to blame. When his council puts a decree in front of him, he signs his name and stamps it with his seal. My council? Who? Who would do that? Not you. Alas, I have been dismissed from the council, although for the nonce they allow me to continue my work with the eunuch's whisperers. The realm is being ruled by Sir Harry Swift and Grand Maester Pycelle. They have dispatched a raven to Casterly Rock, inviting your uncle to return to court and assume the regency. If he means to accept, he had best make haste. Mace Tyrell has abandoned his siege of Storm's End and is marching back to the city with his army, and Randall Tarley is reported on his way down from Maidenpool as well. Has Lord Merryweather agreed to this? Merryweather has resigned his seat on the council and fled back to Longtable with his wife, who was the first to bring us news of the accusations against your grace. They let Tana go. That was the best thing she had heard since the High Sparrow had said no. Tana could have doomed her. What of Lord Waters, his ships? If he brings his crews ashore, he should have enough men to... As soon as word of your grace's present troubles reached the river, Lord Waters raised sail, unshipped his oars, and took his fleet to sea. Sir Harry's fears he means to join Lord Stannis. Pycelle believes that he is sailing to the Stepstones to set himself up as a pirate. All my lovely Dromans, Circe almost laughed. My lord father used to say that bastards are treacherous by nature. Would that I had listened. She shivered. I am lost, Kyburn. No, he took her hand. Hope remains. Your grace has the right to prove your innocence by battle. My queen, your champion stands ready. There is no man in all the Seven Kingdoms who can hope to stand against him. If you will only give the command. This time she did laugh. It was funny, terribly funny, hideously funny. The gods make japes of all our hopes and plans. I have a champion no man can defeat, but I am forbidden to make use of him. I am the queen, Kyburn. My honor can only be defended by a sworn brother of the Kingsguard. I see. The smile died on Kyburn's face. Your grace, I am at a loss. I do not know how to counsel you. Even in her exhausted, frightened state, the queen knew she dare not trust her fate to a court of sparrows. Nor could she count on Sir Kevin to intervene after the words that had passed between them at their last meeting. It will have to be a trial by battle. There is no other way. Kyburn, for the love you bear me, I beg you, send a message for me. A raven if you can, a rider if not. You must send to Riverrun, to my brother. Tell him what has happened, and write. Write? Yes, your grace. She licked her lips, shivering. Come at once. Help me. Save me. I need you now as I have never needed you before. I love you. I love you. I love you. Come at once. As you command. I love you thrice? Thrice. She had to reach him. He will come. I know he will. He must. Jamie is my only hope. My queen, said Kyburn, have you forgotten? Sir Jamie has no sword hand. If he should champion you and lose, we will leave this world together as we once came into it. He will not lose. Not Jamie. Not with my life at stake.
Daenerys. The candle was almost gone. Less than an inch remained, jutting from a pool of warm melted wax to cast its light over the Queen's bed. The flame had begun to gutter.
"It will go out before much longer," Danny realized, "and when it does, another night will be at its end."
Dawn always came too soon. She had not slept, could not sleep, would not sleep. She had not even dared to close her eyes, for fear it would be morning when she opened them again. If only she had the power, she would have made their nights go on forever. But the best that she could do was stay awake, to try and savour every last sweet moment before daybreak turned them into no more than fading memories. Beside her, Dario Naharis was sleeping as peacefully as a newborn babe. He had a gift for sleeping, he'd boasted, smiling in that cocksure way of his. In the field, he would sleep in the saddle oft as not, he claimed, so as to be well rested should he come upon a battle. Sun or storm, it made no matter. "A warrior who cannot sleep soon has no strength to fight," he said. He was never vexed by nightmares either. When Danny told him how Serwyn of the Mirror Shield was haunted by the ghosts of all the knights he'd killed, Dario only laughed. "If the ones I killed come bother me, I will kill them all again."
"He has a sailsword's conscience," she realized then. "That is to say, none at all."
Dario lay upon his stomach, the light linen coverlets tangled about his long legs, his face half buried in the pillows. Danny ran her hand down his back, tracing the line of his spine. His skin was smooth beneath her touch, almost hairless.
"His skin is silk and satin."
She loved the feel of him beneath her fingers. She loved to run her fingers through his hair, to knead the ache from his calves after a long day in the saddle, to cup his cock and feel it harden against her palm. If she had been some ordinary woman, she would gladly have spent her whole life touching Dario, tracing his scars and making him tell her how he'd come by every one.
"I would give up my crown if he asked it of me," Danny thought.
But he had not asked it, and never would. Dario might whisper words of love when the two of them were as one, but she knew it was the Dragon Queen he loved.
"If I gave up my crown, he would not want me."
Besides, kings who lost their crowns oft lost their heads as well, and she could see no reason why it would be any different for a queen. The candle flickered one last time and died, drowned in its own wax. Darkness swallowed the feather bed and its two occupants and filled every corner of the chamber. Danny wrapped her arms around her captain and pressed herself against his back. She drank in the scent of him, savoring the warmth of his flesh, the feel of his skin against her own.
"Remember," she told herself, "remember how he felt."
She kissed him on his shoulder. Dario rolled toward her, his eyes open.
"Daenerys."
He smiled a lazy smile. That was another of his talents. He woke all at once, like a cat.
"Is it done?" "Not yet. We have a while still."
"Liar, I can see your eyes. Could I do that if it were the black of night?"
Dario kicked loose of the coverlets and sat up.
"The half-light. Day will be here soon."
"I do not want this night to end."
"No. And why is that, my queen?"
"You know."
"The wedding." He laughed. "Marry me instead."
"You know, I cannot do that."
"You are a queen. You can do what you like."
He slid a hand along her leg.
"How many nights remain to us?"
"Two. Only two. You know as well as I. This night and the next. And we must end this."
"Marry me, and we can have all the nights forever."
"If I could, I would.
Khal Drogo had been her sun and stars, but he had been dead so long that Daenerys had almost forgotten how it felt to love and be loved. Dario had helped her to remember.
I was dead, and he brought me back to life. I was asleep, and he woke me, my brave captain.
Even so, of late he grew too bold. On the day that he had returned from his latest sortie, he had tossed the head of a Yunkish lord at her feet and kissed her in the hall for all the world to see, until Barristan Selmy pulled the two of them apart. Sir Grandfather had been so wroth that Danny feared blood might be shed.
"We cannot wed, my love. You know why."
He climbed from her bed.
"Marry his daughter, then. I will give him a nice set of horns for his wedding gift. Giscari men like to prance about in horns. They make them from their own hair, with combs and wax and irons."
Dario found his breeches and pulled them on. He did not trouble himself with small clothes.
"Once I am wed, it will be high treason to desire me."
Danny pulled the coverlet up over her breasts.
"Then I must be a traitor."
He slipped a blue silk tunic over his head and straightened the prongs of his beard with his fingers. He had dyed it afresh for her, taking it from purple back to blue, as it had been when first she met him.
"I smell of you," he said,
sniffing at his fingers and grinning. Danny loved the way his gold tooth gleamed when he grinned. She loved the fine hairs on his chest. She loved the strength in his arms, the sound of his laughter, the way he would always look into her eyes and say her name as he slid his cock inside her.
"You are beautiful," she blurted,
as she watched him don his riding boots and lace them up. Some days he let her do that for him, but not today, it seemed.
"That's done with, too."
"Not beautiful enough to marry."
Dario took his sword belt off the peg where he had hung it.
"Where are you going?"
"Out into your city," he said, "to drink a keg or two and pick a quarrel. It's been too long since I've killed a man. Might be I should seek out your betrothed."
Danny threw a pillow at him.
"You will leave Hisdar be."
"As my queen commands. Will you hold court today?"
"No, on the morrow I will be a woman wed, and Hisdar will be king. Let him hold court. These are his people."
"Some are his, some are yours. The ones you freed."
"Are you chiding me?"
"The ones you call your children. They want their mother."
You are chiding me."
"Only a little, Brightheart. Will you come hold court?"
"After my wedding, perhaps. After the peace."
"This after that you speak of never comes. You should hold court. My new men do not believe that you are real. The ones who came over from the windblown, bred and born in Westeros, most of them, full of tales about Targaryens. They want to see one with their own eyes. The frog has a gift for you."
"The frog," she said, giggling. "And who is he?"
He shrugged. "Some Dornish boy. He squires for the big knight they call Green Guts. I told him he could give his gift to me and I'd deliver it, but he wouldn't have it."
"Oh, a clever frog. Give the gift to me."
She threw the other pillow at him.
"Would I have ever seen it?"
Dario stroked his gilded mustachio.
"Would I steal from my sweet queen? If it were a gift worthy of you, I would have put it into your soft hands myself."
"As a token of your love."
"As to that, I will not say. But I told him that he could give it to you."
"You would not make a liar of Dario Naharis?"
Danny was helpless to refuse.
"As you wish, bring your frog to court tomorrow. The others too. The Westerosi."
It would be nice to hear the common tongue from someone besides Sir Barristan.
As my queen commands.
Dario bowed deeply, grinned, and took his leave, his cloak swirling behind him. Danny sat amongst the rumpled bedclothes, with her arms about her knees. So forlorn, she did not hear when Missandei came creeping in with bread and milk and figs.
"Your Grace, are you unwell? In the black of night this one heard you scream."
Danny took a fig. It was black and plump, still moist with dew.
"Will Hestar ever make me scream?" "It was the wind that you heard screaming."
She took a bite, but the fruit had lost its savour now that Dario was gone. Sighing, she rose and called to Iri for a robe, then wandered out onto her terrace. Her furs were all about her. There were never less than a dozen ships drawn up on the shore. Some days there were as many as 100 when the soldiers were disembarking. The Yunkai were even bringing in wood by sea. Behind their ditches they were building catapults, scorpions, tall trebuchets. On still nights she could hear the hammers ringing through the warm, dry air.
No siege towers, though, no battering rams.
They would not try to take Meereen by storm. They would wait behind their siege lines, flinging stones at her until famine and disease had brought her people to their knees.
"Hestar will bring me peace. He must."
That night her cooks roasted her a kid with dates and carrots, but Danny could only eat a bite of it. The prospect of wrestling with Meereen once more left her feeling weary. Sleep came hard, even when Dario came back so drunk that he could hardly stand. Beneath her coverlets she tossed and turned, dreaming that Hestar was kissing her, but his lips were blue and bruised, and when he thrust himself inside her, his manhood was cold as ice. She sat up with her hair dishevelled and the bedclothes tangled. Her captain slept beside her, yet she was alone. She wanted to shake him, wake him, make him hold her, fuck her, help her forget. But she knew that if she did, he would only smile and yawn and say,
"It was just a dream, my queen. Go back to sleep."
Instead, she slipped into a hooded robe and stepped out onto her terrace. She went to the parapet and stood there, gazing down upon the city, as she had done 100 times before.
"It will never be my city. It will never be my home."
The pale pink light of dawn found her still out on her terrace, asleep upon the grass beneath a blanket of fine dew.
"I promised Dario that I would hold court today," Daenerys told her handmaids when they woke her. "Help me find my crown. Oh, and some clothes to wear, something light and cool."
She made her descent an hour later.
"All kneel for Daenerys Stormborn, the Unburnt, Queen of Meereen, Queen of the Andals, and the Rhoyna, and the First Men, Khaleesi of Great Grass Sea, Breaker of Shackles and Mother of Dragons," Missandei called.
Resnick Mo Resnick bowed and beamed.
"Magnificence! Every day you grow more beautiful. I think the prospect of your wedding has given you a glow. Oh, my shining queen."
Danny sighed.
"Summon the first petitioner."
It had been so long that she had last held court that the crush of cases was almost overwhelming. The back of the hall was a solid press of people, and scuffles broke out over precedence. Inevitably, it was Galarza Galari who stepped forward, her head held high, her face hidden behind a shimmering green veil.
"Your Radiance, it might be best were we to speak in private." "Would that I had the time," said Danny sweetly. "I am to be wed upon the morrow."
Her last meeting with the Green Grace had not gone well.
"What would you have of me?" "I would speak to you about the presumption of a certain sellsword captain."
She dare say that in open court?
Danny felt a blaze of anger.
She has courage, I grant that. But if she thinks I'm about to suffer another scolding, she could not be more wrong. The treachery of Brown Ben Plum has shocked us all, she said. But your warning comes too late. And now I know you will want to return to your temple to pray for peace.
The green grace bowed.
I shall pray for you as well.
Another slap, thought Danny, colour rising to her face. The rest was a tedium the queen knew well. She sat upon her cushions, listening, one foot jiggling with impatience. Jaques brought a platter of figs and ham at midday. There seemed to be no end to the petitioners, for every two she sent off, smiling, one left red-eyed or muttering. It was close to sunset before Dario Naharis appeared with his new storm crows. The Westerosi, who had come over to him from the windblown. Danny found herself glancing at them as yet another petitioner droned on and on.
These are my people. I am their rightful queen.
They seemed a scruffy bunch, but that was only to be expected of sellswords. The youngest could not have been more than a year older than she. The oldest must have seen 60 name days. A few sported signs of wealth, gold arm rings, silken tunics, silver-studded sword belts.
Plunder.
For the most part, their clothes were plainly made and showed signs of hard wear. When Dario brought them forward, she saw that one of them was a woman, big and blonde and all in mail. Pretty Maris, her captain named her. Though pretty was the last thing Danny would have called her. She was 6 feet tall and earless, with a slit nose, deep scars in both cheeks, and the coldest eyes the queen had ever seen. As for the rest, Hugh Hungerford was slim and saturnine, long-legged, long-faced, clad in faded finery. Weber was short and muscular, with spiders tattooed across his head and chest and arms. Red-faced Orson Stone claimed to be a knight, as did lanky Lucifer Long. Will of the Woods leered at her, even as he took a knee. Dick Straw had cornflower blue eyes, hair as white as flax, and an unsettling smile. Ginger Jack's face was hidden behind a bristly orange beard, and his speech was unintelligible.
He bit off half his tongue in his first battle,
Hungerford explained to her. The Dornishman seemed different.
If it please your grace, said Dario, these three are Gringotts, Geralt, and Frog.
Gringotts was huge and bald as a stone, with arms thick enough to rival even strong Belwas. Geralt was a lean, tall youth, with sun streaks in his hair and laughing blue-green eyes.
That smile has won many a maiden's heart, I'll wager.
His cloak was made of soft brown wool lined with sand silk, a goodly garment. Frog, the squire, was the youngest of the three, and the least impressive, a solemn, stocky lad, brown of hair and eye. His face was squarish, with a high forehead, heavy jaw, and broad nose. The stubble on his cheeks and chin made him look like a boy trying to grow his first beard. Danny had no inkling why anyone would call him Frog.
Perhaps he can jump farther than the others. You may raise, she said. Dario tells me you come to us from Dorne. Dornishmen will always have a welcome at my court. Sunspear stayed loyal to my father when the usurper stole his throne. You must have faced many perils to reach me.
Too many, said Geralt, the handsome one with the sun-streaked hair. We were six when we left Dorne, your grace.
I am sorry for your losses.
The queen turned to his large companions.
Gringotts is a queer sort of name.
A jape, your grace, from the ships. I was greensick
the whole way from Belantis, heaving and, well, I shouldn't say.
Danny giggled.
I think I can guess, sir. It is, sir, is it not? Dario tells me that you are a knight.
If it please your grace, we're all three knights.
Danny glanced at Dario and saw anger flash across his face.
He did not know. I have need of knights, she said.
Sir Barristan's suspicions had awakened.
Knighthood is easily claimed this far from Westeros. Are you prepared to defend that boast with sword or lance?
If need be, said Geralt, though I will not claim that any of us is the equal of Barristan the Bold.
Your Grace, I beg your pardon, but we have come before you under false names.
I knew someone else who did that once, said Danny, a man called Arston Whitebeard. Tell me your true names, then.
Gladly. But if we may beg the Queen's indulgence, is there some place with fewer eyes and ears?
Games within games. As you wish. Skahas, clear my court.
The shave pate roared out orders. His brazen beast did the rest, herding the other Westerosi and the rest of the day's petitioners from the hall. Her counsellors remained.
Now, Danny said, your names.
Handsome young Geralt bowed.
Sir Geras Drinkwater, your grace. My sword is yours.
Greenguts crossed his arms against his chest.
And my warhammer. I am Sir Archibald Ironwood.
And you, sir?
The queen asked the boy called Frog.
If it please your grace, may I first present my gift?
If you wish,
Daenerys said, curious. But as Frog started forward, Dario Naharis stepped in front of him and held out a gloved hand.
Give this gift to me.
Stone-faced, the stocky lad bent, unlaced his boot, and drew a yellowed parchment from a hidden flap within.
This is your gift? A scrap of writing?
Dario snatched the parchment out of the Dornishman's hands and unrolled it, squinting at the seals and signatures.
Very pretty, all the golden ribbons, but I do not read your Westerosi scratchings.
Bring it to the Queen, Sir Barristan commanded. Now! Danny could feel the anger in the hall.
I'm only a young girl, and young girls must have their gifts, she said lightly. Dario, please, you must not tease me. Give it here.
The parchment was written in the common tongue. The Queen unrolled it slowly, studying the seals and signatures. When she saw the name Sir Willem Darry, her heart beat a little faster. She read it over once, and then again.
May we know what it says, Your Grace?
Asked Sir Barristan.
It is a secret pact, Danny said, made in Braavos when I was just a little girl. Sir Willem Darry, the man who spirited my brother and me away from Dragonstone before the usurper's men could take us, signed for us. Prince Oberyn Martell signed for Dorne, and the Sea Lord of Braavos was witness.
She handed the parchment to Sir Barristan, so he might read it for himself.
The alliance is to be sealed by a marriage, it says, in return for Dorne's help overthrowing the usurper. My brother Viserys is to take Prince Doran's daughter Arianne for his queen.
The old knight read the pact slowly.
If Robert had known of this, he would have smashed Sunspear as he once smashed Pike,
and claimed the heads of Prince Doran and the Red Viper, and, like as not, the head of this Dornish princess, too.
No doubt that was why Prince Doran chose to keep the pact a secret,
suggested Daenerys.
If my brother Viserys had known that he had a Dornish princess waiting for him, he would have crossed a Sunspear as soon as he was old enough to wed, and thereby brought Robert's warhammer down upon himself, and Dorne as well, said Frog. My father was content to wait for the day that Prince Viserys found his army. Your father, Prince Doran.